Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Richard Martin here, yet again, Tuesday, September the 25th, with another moment of joy at a time when there is the greatest disconnect between markets and the economy that I have ever experienced. Those of you who take my email renderings each day will have received three charts this morning, which express the most outrageous breakout in the economic environment to the downside that I have ever seen, totally unaccompanied by the stock market. I want you all to understand that we are very clearly right now in the middle, or rather the beginning, the middle of the beginning, if you like, of a recession. There is no question about this. And anybody who says otherwise is lying to you. It's past the point at which one can really say with a straight face that they're misguided. They're merely trying their best to prop up the last vestiges of a financial services industry which is dying a slow, agonizing death without even knowing it. Ladies and gentlemen, I wanted to talk first of all a little bit about earnings, the earnings of corporations, and how false they really are. One of the primary arguments used by pundits to describe just how bullish and how excellent the economy is the so-called prime quality of the earnings of corporations said to be at record levels. Well, all I can say to you in terms of an example is that if somebody gives you money for a business that you are performing and you know that that actually they can't afford to give you that money, but that they're giving it to you because they borrowed it and they haven't hope and a prayer of ever repaying the loan that they used in order to buy whatever it is your business offers them, can you honestly and truly say with a straight face that your business is thriving? If you can, I feel sorry for you. If, on the other hand, you realize that what is happening is that people are playing the game right up until the moment when they stop the music, then you will take measures today which will protect you for the future. And you have a chance of coming through this unscathed. That will apply to, in my opinion, less than 5% of people in business today. The rest of the people will simply go down with the ship. Sad though it may be to say, the reality is there for all those who wish to take advantage of it. And I would draw your attention in particular to a very interesting article that was published in the New York Times on Sunday, 2 days ago, and it quoted Mark Halbert, who is an analyst of some note, who basically analyzes the people who analyze the market. He doesn't really analyze the market itself. He analyzes those, the operators, the people who are basically in the market, dealing with the brokers, the bankers, the hedge fund people, all of the people who who are responsible for making markets tick, including the private investor. And he comes out with some very interesting research from time to time. And he just came out with a new study which finds compelling evidence that companies actually tinker with their earnings to make themselves look more attractive. The study found that nearly 600 companies over the last 40 years had at some point reported earnings increases for at least 20 consecutive quarters, which is far more than would be expected if no earnings manipulation had taken place. Basically, as long ago as the 1980s, academic researchers had come across evidence that raised suspicions that many companies might be manipulating their earnings. Some companies appeared to be smoothing out their earnings streams, making them look more consistent than they really were. And researchers had contended that this was actually surprisingly easy to do, since accounting rules give companies wide latitude in calculating their earnings. A famous trick is, of course, to transfer some of their discretionary income from one quarter with particularly good earnings to a subsequent quarter in which they might otherwise have had to report a loss. They tend to be saved because researchers have found it very hard actually to prove that earnings manipulation was in fact widespread among publicly traded companies. It does remain a controversial subject in academic circles. This, of course, offers cover to companies that do this because it's extremely difficult to prove. Now, in this new study, the authors pursued an entirely different approach. In effect, they asked the question, if no companies manipulated their earnings, how many would report earnings increases per share for at least 20 consecutive quarters? They focused on publicly traded companies in the United States from the beginning of 1962 right through the first quarter of 2004, which is a period of more than 42 years. Now, the question seems simple, but the actual answer was quite complex. They had to take into account the growth of the economy over the last 40 years, which could make a company more likely to report profits than losses in any given quarter. Obviously, they also had to deal with the tendency of certain industries to have long periods of above-average economic growth. In recent years, oil and oil service companies had been good examples of this. So anyway, after dealing with these and other issues, and assuming that companies didn't manipulate their earnings, they calculated that no more than 46 companies during that 42-year period should have had earnings per share growth for 20 consecutive quarters. But 587 companies actually reported earnings strings of growth. So the professors conclude in their study that the findings constitute, and I quote, prima facie evidence of earnings management. Now, this is a breakthrough, ladies and gentlemen. This is truly an extraordinary development, because earnings have always relied on the inability of the analysts and the outsiders to prove anything against them. The ultimate case, of course, being Enron, which, as you know, was only rumbled by a disgruntled secretary, and she wasn't paid heed to for almost 3 years. Anyway, the study did stress that the earnings manipulation does not have to involve outright fraud. I mean, it could involve something as innocuous as postponing spending on research and development in order to avoid reporting a loss in the current quarter. To gain perspective on pressures that would lead corporate managers to manipulate earnings, the professors leading the study focused on another set of companies whose earnings history would appear just as impressive as those with 20 consecutive quarters of earnings increases, companies whose profits grew just as much over a five-year period, but whose earnings growth rates were slightly more volatile. Each company in this second group reported earnings per share growth in each of the five consecutive years, but had at least one quarter along the way in which earnings per share declined. The professors calculated that the average stock in the first group appreciated nearly 6 percentage points more annualized than the average stock in the second group. The researchers also found that when the average company with 20 consecutive quarterly increases finally experienced a declining quarter, its stock price fell by an abnormally large amount. Actually, they also found that the plunge was steeper the longer the string of quarterly gains that preceded the earnings decline. So, wrapping it all up, these various findings paint a picture of extraordinary pressure on corporate management to sustain strings of consecutive earnings increases for as long as possible. That was from Professor Skinner, who also speculated that many of the managers who eventually engaged in earnings manipulation didn't take their jobs with the explicit intention of doing so. But as the earnings increased for several quarters in a row, these managers became victims of their own success, unwilling to bear the decline in their company's stock price that would almost surely follow if they were to report a profit decline. The clear investment implication is that we shouldn't bet too heavily on companies that have reported long strings of increases in quarterly earnings per share. Such companies' stocks will most likely have already been bid up to too lofty a level and will therefore be especially vulnerable to a big decline once the string of earnings gains comes to an end. Well, that was not meant to be something of great import for you, ladies and gentlemen, but it was really designed to show you, some of you will have understood more than others, but it was designed really to show you that, again, yet another example of what you see is not necessarily what you get, and therefore to be extremely cautious in your reading and your understanding of the economic fundamentals as they pan out. It would take a long time for me to go into all the details of, you know, how these things, how these earnings are manipulated and what is actually done to goose the system, you know, for stock option gains or basically to float more stock on the market at higher levels or whatever reason people might want to see the stocks go up in price. But it is important to get the picture of an industry which is rife with fraud. And my belief is that as things get worse, this fraudulent behavior will be nipped in the bud and lawsuits will go flying in all different directions for many, many years to come. All right, my name is Richard Martin. Richard Martin's Wake Up Call is coming to you from the studios of the Progressive Radio Network. And my personal number, for those of you who might like to call into the show, is 305-357-5575. That, as I said, is my personal number and should be used by those of you who wish to communicate with me privately. Again, 305-357-5575. If you wish to write me an email, you may also do that by writing to rmartin@gscorporation.com. And I will repeat that, all in lowercase, please, with the word corporation written out in full. And if you would be kind enough to make sure that you write the email in all lowercase, that would help to expedite the process. Again, rmartin@gscorporation.com. And then please feel free to call the station itself. That is what I like to hear, people calling in with their questions, their comments, their problems, to the station toll-free at 1-888-873-4643. Again, I repeat, 1-888-873-4643. Right. Now, today, the first thing that we're going to do to talk about is this hoary problem of the Federal Reserve's adding money into the system, doing what we call repurchase agreements, putting interest rates down and doing the job they know how to do, at least that's what they think they know how to do. Because there's a lot of unfortunate misunderstandings that go along with this, and they are fed furiously by the media that make you want to, as usual, buy stocks, buy bonds, whatever it is, and above all, to make you think that the Fed is actually saving the system, they're saving the economy, they're saving the world. Things, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, are much more sober than that. And I'm going to explain this to you using some material that came from John Hussman, who is an excellent analyst, who writes a piece every week. Sometimes I refer to it, so you don't have to feel inclined to do the work yourself. I will do it for you, and if I find anything of importance and use, as always, it will come your way. Now, I'd like to talk about what happened last week, because, as you know, subsequent to the crisis that we saw in an English bank the week before, the Federal Reserve lowered its target for the federal funds rate by 50 basis points. A basis point is 0.01%. So 100 basis points equals 1%. So therefore 50 basis points equals 0.5%. That's the way they have to talk for convenience sake, because if you're talking about 0.38%, it's just easier to say 38 basis points. Okay, 0.5% would be possible, but in the lingo they say 50 basis points instead. They also lowered the discount rate, which is the interest rate the Fed charges on loans to the banking system, by 50 basis points as well. Now, let me just recap. There are two rates of interest that the Federal Reserve can manipulate. One is the federal funds rate, which is the rate that banks charge between each other for loaning money. The other rate is the discount rate, which is the interest rate that the Federal Reserve charges on loans that it makes into the banking system, that's to say to the banks. Okay? Now, what they did last week, it's most important to understand that the impact of those changes is really psychological. Okay? It will have absolutely no bearing on the so-called liquidity of the banking system at all, outside of a pool of a few billion dollars, which is neither here nor there. Nor will it have any effect on the solvency of $3.4 trillion in real estate loans and $6.3 trillion in total bank lending. Now, those are facts. So this is not a matter of opinion. Those are absolutely incontrovertible facts. The raising or the lowering of the Fed fund rates or the discount rate by the Fed has no effect on the system. Okay? Now, that's not to say that the Fed doesn't play an important role in accommodating temporary spikes in the demand for currency, as it did, you know, around the year 2000 turn when you had Y2K and the Fed stood ready to throw money into the system if it was needed to counter a shortfall, and also in providing economic information and data and analysis. But unfortunately, Fed governors generally believe in their own power, not because they actually understand that power as insiders, but because as outsiders, they worked on theoretical models of economies where the links between Fed actions and market interest rates, you know, bank lending and overall GDP, could simply be assumed by writing down one or more algebraic equations. In one of his most referenced papers, for example, Ben Bernanke assumes a, quote, standard dynamic new Keynesian framework. And he said, the most important sectors are a household sector and a business sector. Households are infinitely lived. They work, consume, and save. Business firms are owned by entrepreneurs who have a finite expected life. There is also a government that manages fiscal and monetary policy. End of quote. Also, you will notice that it is generally taken for granted that government determines interest rates and that household and business sectors respond accordingly. In other models that consider money directly, there is typically an equation linking the money supply to the level of interest rates, and everything sort of proceeds nicely from there. Okay, so here's how monetary policy operates in a world like this. The Fed funds rate is set by the Fed using an inflation targeting rule. The actual rate, real interest rate in the economy, is tied directly to the funds rate, which is convenient. The household consumption function is tied directly to the real interest rate that is tied directly to the Fed funds rate. So only by assumption, okay, are the Fed funds rate and thereby the relevant interest rate to consumers and thereby consumption and thereby all economic activity simply controlled by the central bank? Don't ask how. Okay. To see how monetary policy actually works, look at the data by Googling the New York Federal Reserve Bank or the St. Louis Federal Reserve Economic Database. If you examine the data, you'll find that the total level of so-called liquidity that the Federal Open Market Committee deals with is minuscule in relation to a $13.8 trillion economy, and the variation is even smaller. The total reserves of the U.S. banking system are about $40 to $45 billion and are actually very stable. The Fed simply does not inject meaningful amounts of liquidity into the banking system. This is very important for you to understand, ladies and gentlemen, because every one of your friends, relatives, associates, all of them are going to tell you that the bank is, that the Federal Reserve is goosing the system. It actually doesn't happen. Indeed, the latest cuts we saw in Fed-controlled interest rates were effected without any injection of liquidity into the banking system at all. Total borrowings by depository institutions from the Federal Reserve, i.e. borrowings at the discount rate, actually fell last week to $2.421 billion from $3.158 billion the preceding week. That couple of billion dollars is the sum of total of all outstanding borrowers' borrowings at the discount rate. Now, though these figures are still higher than the typical level of discount window borrowing, which is a few hundred million, they are minuscule. Yet these are the figures that investors are revved up about as if this liquidity will save the mortgage market. Meanwhile, there has been no material change in the so-called liquidity provided by the Federal Reserve in the federal funds market either. It's, you know, it's kind of funny and frankly a little bit pathetic how the press and investors get all excited every time the FOMC, that's the Federal Open Market Committee, does an open market operation, as if they represent fresh injections of liquidity into the banking system. They are generally nothing but rollovers of existing repurchase agreements, which we'll come to in a second. Okay? Open market operations come in two flavors, permanent and temporary. About 99% of the monetary base created by the Federal Reserve represents gradual and predictable increases in the amount of currency in circulation. Year to date, the Federal Reserve engaged in what it classifies as permanent open market purchases, amounting to $1.9 billion in February, $6.1 billion in April, and $2.7 billion in May, for a year-to-date permanent increase of just $10.7 billion in the monetary base. Now, not surprisingly, most of this has been drawn off as currency in circulation, which has increased by $9.1 billion since January. So to just wrap this up simply, permanent open market operations are simply the way the Fed increases currency in circulation. It is simply incorrect to believe that these open market operations add meaningfully to the liquidity from which banks are able to make loans. Now, temporary open market operations generally take the form of what we call repurchase agreements, or repos, in which the Fed takes collateral in the form of Treasury securities or U.S. government-backed agency securities and provides funds to banks for periods typically ranging from 1 day to 2 weeks. At the end of the stated period, the banks are obliged to repurchase the securities from the Fed at the sale price plus interest. Now, this is done to help the banks out on a temporary basis when they have currency shortfalls to meet a particular contract or a particular client where their regular cash flow simply doesn't come up to the level needed to do the trick. Therefore, very simply, they borrow the money from the Fed in the form of a repurchase agreement promising the Fed that within the stated period, like 1 day, 2 days, 3 weeks, they will repay the Fed with interest for the money that they borrowed. Now, since reserves are only required on checking deposits, the total amount of reserves in the U.S. banking system is only about $40 to $45 billion. Banks don't hold stack a pile of idle cash in a corner of the vault to maintain these reserves. Instead, they hold securities like Treasury bills and U.S. government bank agency notes, and if they find themselves in need of reserves, they just pledge these securities to the Federal Reserve as collateral. I mean, if we look back at the last month of data, we know that total bank reserves during the period have ranged between about $40 to $45 billion. So, using data on the last 25 Federal Open Market Committee operations reported by the New York Fed, we can tie out the amount of outstanding repurchase agreements on any given day. Now, remember that total reserves include those obtained through discount borrowing and Fed repos, so non-borrowed reserves exclude discount borrowings. Evidently, the majority of the reserves in the U.S. banking system are represented by a continuous rollover of outstanding temporary repurchase agreements. If one set of repurchase agreements for $10 billion matures 3 days from now, you can pretty well predict that the Fed will enter new repurchase agreements of nearly this amount when the existing agreements expire. As a result, the total amount of repos outstanding is fairly stable. Now, this week, when all the pundits, the media, the Jim Cramers, everybody was shouting at you, telling you how much money had been injected into the system by the Federal Reserve, the reality is that on balance, the Fed injected nothing, and I repeat, nothing this week. It is very important to understand how misled investors are when they interpret each new repurchase agreement as if it is a new injection of liquidity into the banking system. The bulk of these repos do absolutely nothing more than to replace the ones that are due. This week provides an instructive opportunity, by the way, to observe this in real time. This Thursday, that's to say in 2 days, an unusually large $24 billion amount of repurchase agreements will come due, leaving only about $7 billion of repos outstanding. It should come as no surprise, then, that the Federal Reserve will most likely enter into a seemingly enormous $24 billion or so in new repurchase agreements by Thursday afternoon. This will undoubtedly be reported with great fanfare and will be interpreted as a massive injection of reserves into the banking system by the Federal Reserve as if these funds are new liquidity. This interpretation will be utterly incorrect. It will do nothing but a rollover of existing repurchase agreements that the Fed routinely enters into in order to maintain a stable amount of reserves in the banking system. That said, if investors are naive enough and by the way, last week's exuberance gives every intention or indication that they are, they may very well rally the stock market on this meaningless and entirely predictable injection of liquidity by the Fed. Though maybe we don't want to speculate on the outcome, it will be interesting to see how Wall Street interprets this rollover. So, ladies and gentlemen, come Thursday, think of me, listen to your program, hear about the enormous injection of liquidity into the market, and laugh. You know, the simple fact is that while the Federal Reserve lowered the Fed funds rate and the discount rate last week, it actually didn't do so by injecting any new funds at all into the banking system. Rather, the Fed lowered these rates strictly by announcing that they were now lower. Now, it's easy to understand this in the context of the discount rate, because the Fed is the only entity that charges that rate. With Fed funds, you can understand how the announcement alone can change the rate by understanding, A, that the entire variation in bank reserves that determines the Fed fund rate amounts to only a few billion dollars, and B, banks are generally willing to follow the rate called out by the Fed so long as it doesn't affect the spread they earn. Okay, well, I will terminate this in a few moments. Let me just give you my number once again for those who are of a mind to make a phone call and ask a question. And the number is toll-free 888-873-4643. Again, 888-873-4643. All right, so let me now conclude my explanation of how these rates and injections work. Think for a second about how borrowers and depositors differ when they choose a bank. If you're a borrower, you frankly couldn't care less about whether an institution is creditworthy. In fact, you'd just as soon have the entire bank vanish into thin air the second after you take your loan. For that reason, so-called offered lending rates like the prime rate, Fed funds, and LIBOR, which we talked about last week, tend to move in lockstep between banks. They tend to coordinate these rates because there's no point in competing on that front. Borrowers can simply look up the rates, compare apples to apples, and choose the lowest cost lender. Indeed, the whole reason that mortgage loans are complicated by points, closing costs, and other fees is because the only way lenders can charge different rates is to make it hard for borrowers to make a clear apples-to-apples comparison. It reminds you somewhat of trying to buy the same car at five different dealerships. They never make it easy for you to compare the prices because they will always offer you the car with different extras. Some will have, you know, a Bose fine sound system. Others will have XM radio. Others will have XM radio plus automatic drive. Others will have manual stick shift plus a sunroof. So you could never make a proper comparison about how to shop for a car. And this is done, of course, on purpose. So it's strictly on the bid side, the savings deposit rates, CD rates, interest checking rates, that you see a wide variation in the interest rates paid to depositors. Okay? As a result, you'll generally observe that when the Fed lowers the Fed funds rates, banks often lower other so-called offered rates, like the prime rate and LIBOR, but they also simultaneously lower deposit rates. As long as they can maintain the spread between deposit rates and lending rates, they're often willing to change the levels, though you'll notice there's currently still a wide spread between LIBOR and Fed funds here. No new liquidity needs to be introduced, and there's typically no material change in either the volume of deposits or the volume of loans. The data simply don't demonstrate any significant elasticity in either the demand for funds or the supply of deposits in response to marginal changes in Fed-controlled rates. outside the banking system, you'll notice that while Fed-controlled interest rates dropped last week, market-controlled interest rates rose. Treasury yields increased at nearly all maturities, as did mortgage rates, including those on 30-year conventional mortgages. Indeed, the only relief to borrowers was on rates tied to LIBOR, which fell. But even this is not new purchasing power for the economy, because the drop was matched by a reduction in deposit rates. So any relief to borrowers with rates tied to LIBOR came entirely at the expense of savers. Again, the argument is not that interest rates are irrelevant or that there is no relationship between total government liabilities and inflation, though the tightest relationship is between government spending growth, regardless of how it is financed, and inflation, particularly over horizons of 4 to 5 years. The argument is that there is no credible mechanism by which Fed actions control the economy. Ladies and gentlemen, did you get that? I will repeat that last sentence. The argument is that there is no credible mechanism by which Fed actions control the economy. The bottom line: the much celebrated move by the Fed last week created no new liquidity, no new reserves, and no new purchasing power. Given all that, it's unlikely that all of this will result in any material improvement in the solvency of the mortgage market. All right, we're done. We're finished with that. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been probably the most turgid talk I've ever given. But it is essential to know this. If you are interested in understanding how the economy works and how the cycles move up and down, you have to understand the nonsense that you are told about the Federal Reserve. Because the Federal Reserve gets a bad rap, but for the wrong reasons. Now, I've talked about Alan Greenspan, and I've talked about what a villain he was. And he really was a villain, because he did things which were not in the interests of the general public, but they were in the interests of the Financial Services Corporation. But what he did and what he should have done has really nothing to do with what I've been talking about. What I've been talking about today has been elements about the injection of money into the system which are false, and which you are deliberately led to believe by the financial services company in order to make you think that the Fed loves you and is going to help you to make money, and therefore you should trust them and go ahead, buy your house, buy your stocks, sit back and watch the profits grow. Nothing could be further from the truth. So I actually strongly recommend that if you didn't quite get what I said to you today, just in terms of the Federal Reserve, I suggest you wait for the archive and listen to this bit again. It's very important. And the only reason it's important isn't because of the importance it has, per se, which is rather middling, actually. Its importance is because it allows you to refute the nonsense you're told, thereby enabling you to get a better impression as to what is happening in the economy. Because I guarantee that at one point, when the economy has slowed to such a level that people's livelihoods are at risk, the Fed will then attempt to goose the system by injecting permanent reserves through the purchase of government paper, government bonds and bills, etc. And that, of course, by that point, will have lost its usefulness, because nobody will want the money because people are too scared. They'll be too busy selling. They certainly won't want to use any extra money to buy with, because they will feel that that money will go down the drain, just like all the other money that they put into their investments, and therefore they will leave the money on the table. Okay. All right. Now, I wanted just to mention a new development which has taken place in real estate. And it concerns commercial real estate. One of the things that you've been told that you need to bear in mind is that, okay, the residential real estate market may have collapsed, but the commercial real estate market is still as strong as ever, going from strength to strength. Therefore, you just need to transfer your investments from residential to commercial real estate and all will be well. Well, as usual, this is nonsense, and real estate does lag by a given amount, as we shall see in a few minutes. And indeed, now with real estate in the residential mortgage arena having taken a fairly sizable tumble, the days are now gone of sort of frenzied commercial property sales with investors buying buildings at high prices, raising rents, and flipping them at even higher prices. We're getting information now by people like Joseph Cosenza, who is vice chairman of the Inland Real Estate Group of companies in Oak Brook, and he says, quote, for landlords, it's a vicious cycle. The more landlords lower rents, the more property values sink. Well, this has got to be familiar for all of you in residential real estate. I'm here to tell you that it's now coming to real estate in the commercial arena near you. Okay. Cosenza added, and I quote, if a landlord can't sell a building and can't afford to pay the 95% leverage on it, plus operating expenses, they're likely to default. Well, that comes from Illinois, but the problems are not confined to the Midwest. And Cosenza said again, quote, all across the country, there are huge spaces where tenants aren't paying rent. In Orange County, California, the subprime mortgage industry crisis and Orange County's economic tailspin are likely to have a chilling effect on nearly all types of commercial real estate in this formerly go-go market. And those are analysts who seem to have this fairly unanimous opinion about real estate. A number of shrinking mortgage companies are already dumping office space on the market, which, of course, in turn will pinch consumer spending, while budget-constrained would-be renters may forego their own homes and apartments in favor of doubling up with parents or friends. And that comes from Kenneth Rosen, chairman of Rosen Consulting Group, a Berkeley, California real estate research firm. Again, in the arena of commercial real estate, there is a gentleman called Sam Chandan, the chief economist for Rice, which is a New York research company. And Chandan said in the second half of the year, about 26.2 million square feet in strip malls will be completed, which would contribute to an oversupply. That's the highest level of completions we've seen in many years, and it coincides with the slowdown in the underlying drive for space. The strip mall vacancy rate has accelerated sharply in some metropolitan areas, including Trenton, Dallas, and Oakland, California, according to Abigail Marks, an economist at Torto Wheaton Research, which is a Boston company. Like residential mortgages, commercial mortgages are pooled, sorted into risk categories, and sold as bonds. Is this or is this not a familiar story? Well, guess what? In the past several weeks, the demand for these bonds has weakened, with investors demanding to be paid more for the risk, and as a result, lenders are changing the terms of deals. And I quote from Pete Bethea, a principal at Burnham Real Estate, which is a brokerage firm in San Diego, quote, even if people thought that they had their deal locked, there's no such thing. Well, as I said just now, this is a really new development. The news is actually a drastic turnaround from just 3 weeks ago when the market seemed to be on a constant upward trajectory. The LA Times reports that the global credit crunch that has rattled financial markets for the last few weeks is finally reaching the vast commercial real estate investment and development industry. Now, as I said before, and I promised to follow up with this, commercial real estate fortunes follow residential ones with a lag. And what we're seeing is that that lag has been used up. Vacancy rates are soaring in many locations and rents are dropping. It's absolutely clear, yet again, that the economy is slowing, the jobs picture is horrendous. There is absolutely no reason for businesses to expand in this environment. Far from being the savior that many think, commercial real estate is soon going to get crushed. It is overbuilt, overloved, and due for a collapse. If Bernanke thinks he has a problem now, watch what happens when commercial real estate blows up. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the consolidators that I refer to very frequently, they might be able to keep people in their houses in lieu of foreclosure by renegotiating terms down and down and down again for a while anyway, and certainly not forever. But bank funding of unneeded strip malls is quite another thing. So here we are, ladies and gentlemen, right near the tip-top in commercial real estate insanity, where no price was too high to pay for a building on the silly belief that property values would continually rise and lease prices right along with them. Few bother to note that commercial real estate is now staring over the abyss. Given how rapidly investor psychology is changing in this sector, it won't take much now to send it over the edge. Well, that comes largely, the information there comes from Mish Shedlock, which is Mike Shedlock, and I have referred to him several times in the past, and he's particularly closely associated with real estate. So I thought I would bring that to you just to warn you, especially those of you who may be invested in commercial real estate, that your time is up. All right. We have Frank calling from New York. Hello, Frank. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Richard, if you had 30-year treasuries, would you sell them now or hold on?
Hold on.
Hold on?
I'll tell you why. You know, basically, we're in between a rock and a hard place here, Frank. I do think that as the dollar falls, and the dollar, as you know, is falling very sharply right now. I won't say there's a panic, but it is falling very sharply indeed. Now, as the dollar falls, Frank, foreigners are inevitably going to be selling some of their treasury holdings, aren't they? You know, why would they go on holding, you know, why would they go on holding treasury bonds if the dollar falls and, you know, those bonds for them are, you know, losing value? Just in terms of the dollar. So many of these institutions are going to be panicking out of bonds.
Right,
and this is going to be very serious because this is really going to affect interest rates. Unlike what I've been talking about for most of this session, interest rates are not going to be affected by the Federal Reserve, but they are most certainly going to be affected by people who sell their bonds. Because as you know, when bonds fall, interest rates rise.
Right.
So you may say to me, okay, well, then why shouldn't I sell my bonds? The answer to that is because after the fall of the bond price, however low it's going to go, and it will go maybe quite appreciably lower, but not that much, they will turn around and they will come up, and bond investments will be the finest investments that you can make because as the economy implodes, the demand for money will decrease. Therefore, banks will not be able to charge the same interest rates for long-term loans that they could charge, say, today. And therefore, the interest rates will come down, and therefore the bond prices will rise. And this will encourage people to buy bonds. And therefore, bonds will rise not on a knee-jerk reaction like the fall of the bond price right now. They will rise according to an ongoing trend which has been in progress for about 20 years. So I see long-term 30-year bond prices much higher a year from today, but in the meantime, there may be quite a little bit of a valley. Does that answer your question, Frank?
Yeah, but so you don't think it's too risky to sell them now and buy them back?
No, if you want to sell them now, that's fine, but but you know you're going to get you won't get your interest, and you'll have to buy maybe treasury bills or something in the meantime. If you want to do, if you want to trade your bonds, yes, you could sell them now and buy them back sometime in the future. I don't know when, but you should be able to buy lower than you sell them today. Sure, if you'd like to do that, then be my guest. I'm nothing against it, but just be sure if you're a bond guy, if you like bonds, make sure that you're back in those bonds before they start moving up. Otherwise, you'll miss the move, and then you'll be really furious with yourself that you sold them in the first place, and then you'll come after me, and I'll be as the driven snow.
Well, just the second part of the question, when is all this going to happen?
When is all what going to happen, Frank?
Everything going to fall apart.
Well, housing's already fallen apart. Have you noticed?
But the market keeps going up.
Well, the market keeps going up because the investors are still living in cloud cuckoo land. I mean, the commercial real estate was still going up until about a month ago. You know, that these things turn. Residential real estate was still going up until, late 2005, early 2006. These markets turn in their own sweet time, and you can't force it, and I can't force it, but what you can do is to position yourself for the eventuality that this will happen. And that's what each and every person needs to do, specifically by selling your assets that you don't need, because those will fall in value. Sell your assets and prepare for the downturn in the economy. And then, at a slightly later stage, buy your long-term bonds. Thank you, Frank. We have Chuck from New York, who is on the line, hopefully.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Thank you. I just had a question. If you have real estate, say commercial, is there some kind of instrument? I mean, of course you should try to sell it, and I was trying to do that. But is there an instrument that you could hedge against, the downturn? Or
there are REITs, real estate investment trusts. There are commercial REITs that you can you can use. They pay an excellent yield. Obviously, because as you probably may know, REITs must, by law, pass through 90% of their earnings to the investor. So that gives you a really nice rate of return on REITs. But again, you want to be very careful there, because if you're wrong, if the market goes down, then obviously the value of your REITs will go down. It's not really a hedge. It's not really the answer to your question. I guess the answer to your question is probably no, that there isn't anything you can do in that regard. There is a stock I think it's the Amex, or it could be the NYSE, I forget which, called TLT. And TLT is basically an exchange-traded fund which deals with the market in 20-year treasuries. So if you were to sell short the market in treasuries and interest rates were to rise, then you could make money that way and as a kind of hedge. But you don't want to be involved with that, Chuck. If you have commercial real estate, you're going to have such huge problems with your tenants that you just want to get out of the damn stuff. You don't want to sit in commercial real estate like an idiot knowing that it's going to fall. It's not really a hedgeable function. It's not like as if you had IBM or General Electric and you thought they were going to go down for a few months and then come back up and you could sell some call options against it and do a nice hedge. You're really better off outside. You're dealing with human beings, and human beings that don't have money are ugly people, let me tell you, because they're going to make life very difficult for you. Anyway, thank you very much, Chuck. Thank you, Frank. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I will be back with you on Friday, as usual. This is Richard Martin, Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, wishing you a very successful and prosperous remainder of the week. See you on Friday. Thank you, and goodbye.